On this week's show, The Clone Zone, Digital Twins in Action with Dylan Underhill from Trillium Advisory Group. In this week's news, are construction technology providers overlooking their most important asset? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right. Tanis, it feels like I just saw you.
I think you did. Just last week.
It's just last week. And it's going to be out soon on a podcast near you, on a platform near you. We did our first ever on stage. That was fun.
That was a lot of fun. It's kind of weird not sitting in front of a microphone like we are right now, sitting in front of an audience, but we had a good time. We had some great questions from the audience. It was exciting. It was nice to finally meet Nathan in person in real life. And yeah, it was good to see you again. It was a great show.
It was great to see you. And you only hit your microphone once. So, you know, maybe we can get over that. You know, we got the thing in front of you again. So if you guys don't know, Tanis talks with her hands a little bit. So every once in a while we get a mic slap instead of a mic drop, which is,
I know, you know, right? It's just not as exciting.
It's all right. Dylan, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm really excited to get into your stories and you know, dig into another person out there kicking it. But we got to admit it. I got to just say it. The title brought to you today by ChatGPT. That's right. We had a little bit of fun beforehand. We're going to pull back. And we used a little ChatGPT to help us out today, didn't we, Tanis?
We did. We weren't sure what it was going to throw at us, but we were surprisingly quite excited about some of the titles that it came up with. The Clone Zone, I have to say, I wouldn't have come up with that on my own, but that is pretty epic. So good job, ChatGPT.
Yeah, right, Dylan? That was a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's, you got to admit that that's fun to say, and it makes a lot of sense. So how can you not go with it?
Exactly. All right. So before we dive into everything, what got you here, Dylan? Tell us a little bit about your story and, you know, how you got to where you are today in Trillium. And we're going to get into digital twins, et cetera. But, you know, give us a little bit about your history.
Yeah, I really got into the industry because I loved 3D modeling and I loved video games. And I thought, this isn't probably what I'm going to end up doing for the rest of my life, but it would be cool to apply that somewhere else. And then I went to school for architectural technology because I liked modeling homes and things like that. And it just kind of kept going from there. I went to Denmark to do a little bit more schooling, and that was more focused on interdisciplinary, like IPD approach type construction. And you know, from there, I got a lot of cool experience being in Denmark with a lot of unique people from all over the world. And eventually, I moved over to Vietnam, where I got to do BIM management for big projects. And that was very eye-opening because I was just coming off, you know, learning Revit and 3ds Max. And now we're doing, you know, a super tall in Kuala Lumpur, and we're doing, you know, train stations in Germany. And it was all of a sudden, and it's fast paced, and it's so much further than where the industry was in Canada. So it was a really big, you know, uplift on my side to train myself and look for knowledge where it didn't necessarily already exist, come up with cool solutions. And that problem solving aspect of it was really important for where I kept ending up. So I came back to Canada. I did architectural technology for an architecture company. It was great. They were great. But I was working in AutoCAD, and that's not where I wanted to be. And so I moved to a GC, and we were doing, you know, big Revit projects, and we were deploying robotics, and we had reality capture, and I could go and speak to universities here and make a better connection with the BIM community at large. And that really cemented in, BIM and VDC and all of those cool technologies and processes that help the site do what they need to do without being like overly pushy. So it was cool to be able to go to a site and bring an iPad and show some general modeling and get them to use the model and not demand that they use the model. And then that spread naturally. And then I finally got here to Trillium. My first interview was with Tanis, and we got to do a lot of cool projects and problem solving. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. Bring back that unique problem solving aspect, a different day every day. And, that's what being a BIM and VDC consultant is. It's something new every single day, and it's been a blast so far.
So unfortunately, I have to go all the way back to the beginning there. And
for sure,
you're telling me that my kiddo, I have a 16-year-old who's a video gamer, that there is a future in video games, huh?
Absolutely. Like just from a construction standpoint, modeling the environment in a video game is very similar to modeling the environment that you're going to build. And all of those programs actually interact very well with one another. That never used to be the case, but now I'm doing development in Unreal Engine, and Unreal Engine is a video game engine. When I was at a GC, we were doing stuff in Unity, and Unity is a video game development engine. So they already have it figured out for creating these universes. BIM and VDC is trying to replicate that. It's an easy jump across.
The analogy and the similarities are not drawn enough there, that it really is. And that's why I think Unity and Unreal have really, changed the game when it comes to what many consider a digital twin and what that really means and how it works. So, I want to go back. So, you went to school for a while, you got an education, but again, you got in the field in Vietnam and other places. And the reality was the tools you had, you weren't using yet. There's still a lot of folks that you're probably consulting today that are in that position. So how does that experience help you? Because many of those tools weren't even documented at that point, right? They were just burgeoning, brand new. Yeah. So how does that help you with what you do today? And what was that experience like kind of being on the forefront?
I think a lot of it helps you kind of define what the end goal is a lot better, because I've seen kind of how far you can take BIM and VDC and apply it to the highest tech project with a massive budget. And then I've seen people getting by with napkin sketches and AutoCAD. So taking the experience of this is the best you could do, and scaling it to what is appropriate for the client or the GC that's come to me, or Subtrade, or whoever it is, that's the most valuable takeaway, is just scaling what I think is going to benefit them the most, rather than, okay, go buy this license, get this technology, change your hard hat to this one with the unicorn camera on top. Like, that's been the best momentum I've gained from that experience.
Tanis, I'm interested in your thoughts here.
Dylan, I love to explore career trajectories through those impactful moments and relationships that really propel people. Who in your professional career, or even, perhaps somebody you haven't even met yet, but you really are inspired by the way they think or the way they approach things, who's had the biggest impact on your career? Because you've done a lot of things. So I'm curious, is there one person, or perhaps two or three people, that have had a big impact on where you are today?
Obviously, my parents had a lot of support for the things I was doing and letting me play video games and say, hey, I can turn that into a career. That was great for them. I had kudos for letting me do that. I had a few professors while I was at SAIT here in Calgary, that they gave me the opportunity to explore something that wasn't necessarily part of maybe the curriculum, and kind of carve out what I thought was the correct path forward. I had a lot of people along the way that were like that, where I would come in as, you know, here's your job description or here's what needs to be delivered. And they just let me kind of be who I wanted to be and develop something that I wanted to develop. And it, maybe it wasn't always the best way to deliver something. And, you know, I can be a little bit slow on certain deliverables, but I have like a very strong sense of, you know, quality and what that looks like. A lot of that came from one teacher. His name's Janos at SAIT. He retired a few years ago, but he recommended me like a few books, and those books helped, you know, drive a lot of the values that I have in what I deliver. And it helped quite a bit having people at these companies that I went to, like you, Tanis, or at Pomerlo, Ivanka was great in just driving that, you know, we believe in technology. We believe in, you know, developing something that is going to help our clients or help teams, or this is the way the industry is going. All of that really helped push me to where I wanted to go and what I wanted to be.
That's awesome. And I think that's such an important message, because you are working in a part of the industry that the general public probably isn't overly familiar with. So when you talk about a career in engineering or construction, you're going to think of very traditional career paths, either doing design or actually building in the field. And you're in an area that combines some very unique skills. I mean, video game capability. There's probably a lot of people who have teenage kids out there who are playing video games. They're telling them to get off the video games so they can go do schoolwork and study or do chores around the house. I mean, there are so many career opportunities in this industry, and they're not always through the traditional career route. So if you're out there listening and you're a parent or you're considering a career in construction, reach out and talk to people like Dylan, because there are avenues throughout the industry that you may not even be aware of that leverage unique skill sets, and you can really have an impact on construction projects. So that's awesome. I love the video game tie-in, because I hear that story all the time from friends of mine with kids who are trying to get their kids off of video games. And now I can tell them, let them play more video games. They'll end up in a very amazing career in our industry.
Yeah, there's tons of great studies out there that show that, you know, video games as a whole can be beneficial for the development of, you know, quick thinking, decision making, eye-hand coordination. There's all of that. But just fostering that, hey, you like video games, well, what if you could do that on a construction site? You can do that in real life, you know. And I've had lots of people in the past talk to me, and they come up and they say, hey, my kid's 15. They really like drawing. They really like video games. Like, maybe an art degree isn't the right thing, but, you know, what can we do with maybe an architectural technology background? And there's so many things you can do with an architectural technology background. And I always recommend it as something. If you're not really sure where you want to go, you know, an architectural technology background gives you the ability to move into, get a little taste of 3D modeling, get a little taste of construction management. You could become an estimator. There's so many ways you could branch out of it, but the base is there to give you, you know, that outlook of the different things you could do if you wanted to.
Yeah, it's that foundational skill set, Dylan. That's the key. And what I talk to parents about, and I try to talk to my own son about a lot, is understand how those games are built. Mm-hmm. Right. Get into the programming languages, get into the mystery, you know, remove the mystery behind the games to understand how they're built. And then, you know, it's like most of us who walk into a hotel and lay down in bed and don't think about, I'm on the 14th floor and what if it fell through? Like, we just don't think about that, right? Because it's just built. They walk into the game, they play the game. It's like, think about how the game was built. Think about how the building was built. And then maybe you can be a part of somehow building it digitally or enabling our field to build it, right? There are, and there should be, more people out there actually building. But I think when you combine some of the things you're working on now in robotics, you know, maybe you are operating things with a video controller, right? We've seen the futuristic looks of a lot of vehicles those steering wheels look a lot like a video game controller. So again, it's that hand-eye coordination to do things. But before we get all the way to the future, you've kind of been through and you talked about, hey, look, I was in CAD and I didn't really want to be there. You've gone into BIM and VDC and explored the tools. How you said this along the way, like bringing the iPad out there, how do you connect? Because this is where I think it loses its kind of luster in a lot of places, is how do you connect BIM and VDC to the built world, to the people building, to the project itself, like draw value?
Yeah, it's difficult, right? Because if I go on site with an iPad and a million demands on, you need to be at this coordination meeting and you need to have this license to look at the model, and you know, this guy has been in the field for 40, 50 years, he's just going to yell at me and then we're not getting anything accomplished. So I think a lot of people come in a little too ambitious and a little too hot, right? And that becomes a huge turnoff for these people that are, you know, working day to day, breaking their back, and then some office guy with shiny new boots and a shiny hard hat comes and tells them how to do their job better, or tells them that basically, I'm going to get you off this project sooner, or I'm going to scrutinize your pricing more. And that is the wrong way to approach it. The best way, and the way that I've only ever gotten buy-in, is find like a few people that are on site and just get them to do one task in the model and just see if it helps them. Do they feel more comfortable with the work that's upcoming? Were you able to open the model and look at a detail that you didn't understand from the drawings? And did that help you plan out something else? Then, you know, they're doing that kind of organically. And then that organic transition goes, instead of me telling you to do the model stuff, you now have a foreman that's telling his guys, hey, this was really cool, this worked for me. And they have a subtrade talking to a different subtrade, and they say, hey, this is really cool. And that kind of becomes that natural grassroots adoption of technology. But there's certain things that are always going to be harder to implement. But as this older generation of, you know, skilled trades transitions out, which, I mean, everybody knows is happening, the newer generation is looking at these cool, you know, video game-esque construction techniques and having robotics and, you know, the HoloLens on site and stuff like that. And they're excited by it, and they get to come in and do all these cool things. Sure, they're going to get beat up a little bit by the older generation that's still kicking around, but there's kind of two ways you have to approach it, and you have to see who your audience is and understand like how to get them excited about it. Because I can be as excited as I want. If nobody on site wants to do it, then I mean, I'm just kind of alone in my room looking at a BIM model instead of actually getting anything productive done.
Well, you hit on a couple of things there, and I'm gonna split it up a little bit. The first one is welcome to, you're in the middle of the two generations now, so you're like the bridge of the gap. And the first piece was, we can go way back, and Tannis, this will predate all of us in here. There was this guy named Darren Roos, the Rooster, that was on the show really early on, and it's the most wild thing. He would hide R2-D2 in the model and offer up a full-size Snickers, not a small Snickers, because small Snickers won't work, full-size Snickers, first person who could find it. There was all, and they had a computer that they could go up to in the trailer and try and find it. You found it, full-size Snickers. Then it created a gamification. People wanted their Snickers, but they all of a sudden got to learn the model. And then it was, hey, I need to find this. And it was like, oh, I already know how to fly around because I find R2-D2 every day and get my Snickers. So you've done the same thing, but with what I think is a critical little twist on, you know, Darren was just trying to really, that was early days of the tools, right? Just trying to get some comfort. Now there's a comfort, but really a what's in it for me? Why do this? And you just said, like, you bring them the Wiffle, they can, instead of the stick, you're bringing the carrot. Like, you'll be able to find this. You'll be able to get this answer. And how do you then like pass that knowledge on to this new group coming in and saying, listen, this is how you got to bridge that gap? Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more.
First thing, I used to hide Godzilla in the models because I always thought it was funnier when he was coming out of the landscape or something. But yeah, we would always try to do that in school, hide Godzilla in a cupboard or something. But yeah, bridging the gap, it's going to be kind of bespoke to every site. Like you said, gamification of technology is a great motivator, right? As a general populace, we're all very competitive. Guys on site, even more, right? So having statistics or ways to reward interaction with the media is good for them. And then, you know, they're going to be a little bit more competitive when the new younger guy comes on site and he's like, oh yeah, I know how to do this super easy. So you can kind of draw even more competition when you have younger guys competing against more experienced site guys. But bridging the gap between the two is always going to be a little bit difficult. That's super complex, really.
I like it though. You broke it down really well because, you know, and I love to hear that you were hiding things earlier. Everybody has their thing, you know, Star Wars, Godzilla, whatever it might be, and getting comfortable. But you've also hit like those people in the field have been building for a really long time and they've been successful. And I think we beat them over the head that they haven't been successful. And we're just opening up to a new toolkit. And you're saying, listen, respect the fact that they have been doing this and can do it. And by the way, now that we're enabling them with tools, they're still better than you and they're faster. And that competition, we don't talk about it enough. Like if one trade's using it and the other trade sees it, they want it. They want to be better, right? Yeah. There's always a constant improvement in construction. I don't think they get credit for that will.
No, they don't. And whenever I'm on a project as, the owner rep or the general contractor in a design build, I always reiterate that the model, the BIM, the VDC process is not there to point fingers and blame, you know, the guys on site for being too slow or the modeling team for having bad models or, you know, whatever it is. It's to be collaborative and focus on that collective intelligence that the site guys have. So I don't need to have a model from a designer that's fresh out of school and then yell at a construction guy because he's not doing it exactly the way we wanted. I want to bring everybody in the room and say, hey guys, this is what we're building. What makes the most sense? Is there a different sequence we could do? Give everybody in the room a chance to speak up and say, no, I would do it this way. And okay, if you're doing it that way, let's explore what that looks like in the model. And then everybody gets to feel more engaged in the entire process. And then again, they're going to use the tools a little bit more.
Power of combined capability, right? It's all about leveraging tools to enable people to do things that they already do well, even better. I think we really underestimate the power of gamification in our industry, and I'm a competitive person. So if you offered me a Snickers bar to find R2-D2, I probably would have been the least productive person on site, but I would have gotten a Snickers every day. So there would be that. It kind of reminds me of the commercial, what would you do for a Klondike bar? I'd find Godzilla. That's what I would do. Yeah. And that would be my first priority. But I think that's great, right? If you can find ways to engage people that's not forceful, it draws them in. There's a lot of power in that. And if we think about applications, I mean, a lot of us spend a lot of time on our phones. And there are apps that we use more frequently than others. And we want to use those applications. I think we need to approach development in our industry the same way. We have to build technology that people want to use, that is not a mandatory part of the workflow, but it's an exciting part of the workflow that people are drawn into because it creates value for them. Like Jeff said, the what's in it for me. Dylan, I want to pivot to the future, not really the future, it's kind of the today, but looking into the future of our industry and specifically the area that you're working in, which is digital twinning. And this is a topic area that garners a lot of attention and a lot of discussion. And if anybody spends any time on LinkedIn, you've probably seen many topics and threads on this. But digital twinning is a term that's, in my opinion, it's been overused. And it's been picked up and what was a digital twin that was somewhat well-defined evolved into everything 3D being a digital twin and mass confusion. So being that you work in this space, how do you define a digital twin and how do you work with teams to really definitively outline what a digital twin is and what it is not?
Yeah. Like you said, it's a buzzword right now, right? Everybody's trying to use it and everybody's trying to say that they're product or process is a digital twin and it's a true twin and it's, and realistically, most of the time it's not. And the definition that I try to simplify or say, you know, a digital, what is a real digital twin is it does have to have that feedback loop. And the digital twin itself becomes more of an interface to the data twin that runs in the background. So a digital twin is kind of this, we always say like a single pane of glass and you've got all these apps and modules and things running in the background to drive the digital twin. And the digital twin is where people interact and get whatever information or data is coming from their asset in a more digestible format. So instead of having a BIM expert fly you through the model, someone on site can, you know, click on something with their finger and that has this intuitive way of bringing up information about the asset, or maybe they can get to the documentation. It doesn't all need to be in the digital twin, but it needs to be accessible through it. It becomes that common data environment type thing, but for people that aren't necessarily super nuanced in the way BIM or VVC technology works or functions between one another. But yeah, like, you know, point cloud is not a digital twin. A 3D model is not a digital twin. It's the same conversation we had when Revit came out, right? Saying, you know, Revit isn't BIM alone. BIM is, you know, that model element with metadata and properties and being able to pull all of that information. It's the same conversation again. We're just moving on to digital twin as the term.
That's key, right? It's more about the methodology. It's the workflow behind it. It's not necessarily a single technology that you deploy that gives you a digital twin. Yeah. It's more about enabling technologies and the integrations between those information flows and the data sets that enables people to pull that information through a single pane of glass. But like you said, having that feedback loop as well. So it's a digital representation of something that exists in the physical world. So you've got that full feedback loop. Like you said, a point cloud is as cool as it is. It in itself is not a digital twin, but that's an enabling technology. It's one of the technologies that can be used to create a digital twin, but it itself is not one. Jeff, I know you've got some thoughts on the topic, and I think Dylan's speaking your language with the data twin. What do you think?
Well, that's I was going to give you a round of applause for that one, Dylan, because digital twin has become a buzzword. And like you said, all those different things, but you tied it back to the key. It's got to be about data.
Yeah.
It is a common data environment. And I would love for the industry to start to look at the digital twin as exactly what you said. It's that pane of glass that allows each user the access to the data and information that they need. Sometimes that's a scan. Sometimes that's a point cloud. Sometimes it's just a change order. Sometimes it's just a daily report or a clash detection item. Whatever it is, I should have a common data environment to go access it. And if that became the definition, Tanis, I'm going to say this live. If what Dylan just said became the definition, I would start using digital twin because it is that interactive, living, breathing project, whatever it is. If it's a you know, if you're talking about an oil and gas and you're talking about a refinery or you're talking about a lab, like they're so different, or a healthcare facility, right? They're all so different. So there's this one definition just never fit. And like you said, marketing's marketing and we're going to hype it up. So I want to pivot you to like, so now that we're kind of like in agreement of what the broader definition of this digital twin is, how do you get teams to get past that and really like keep it up to date and keep it moving, right? Because if at any point it stops, it's no longer a twin.
Yeah. And you make a great point, right? Like every digital twin is going to be wildly different than any other digital twin. So being able to say definitively, this is a digital twin is very difficult because it looks so different for everybody else. And the models and the point clouds, yes, become building blocks for that final application, but they're not the twin themselves. If you're looking at how to make a digital twin process actually work, I think the best way is looking at your BIM process, your BIM model, your VDC process, and trying to transition that into that asset operational phase. And then once you're kind of at that first step, when I look at a digital twin, I've been calling them modules. And so I would say, you know, here's your digital twin. The first module is a 3D view. The second module is an IoT sensor feedback for a few assets. And then you can keep building on that. So you don't have to have every module built right at the beginning. But if you make really good models that are easy to path and create those data connections to, you know, outside the ecosystem, then you can start building modules whenever you need them. And you can create that complexity creep where similar to what I was talking about in the field, you want to start off small and then get it to grow naturally. That's the best way to do it. Have a few modules. Let the guy on site be able to see the model, see, you know, work orders that are coming up, and that's it. And then, you know, he can log in his own information and then, hey, could we do this other thing with a digital twin? Absolutely, we can do that other thing. And hey, we want to leverage more data in the back end to throw, you know, machine learning on top of it. Perfect. That's exactly what we want to do for that end goal. We've seen where it can go. We know what the height of a digital twin is. We'll guide you on that path. And that's, you know, it's baby steps, but it's really like sitting down with a client or an owner and saying, okay, look, I know you've seen LinkedIn digital twin posts, and I know you've seen all of these reports that say digital twin is the future. Here's what it looks like in a realistic sense. What it takes to develop and deploy is going to be more than you expect. A digital twin, an actual digital twin on a project, is probably 1% of 1% of all projects. So it's not just go and buy the software. You've got a digital twin. Congratulations. Here's your 15% maintenance reduction over the lifespan of the project. It's what do you need to make your asset run better? What does it look like for you? Are you trying to be more efficient? Are you trying to reduce man hours? Are you trying to train people before they hit site? That's what matters, and guide them through that.
Oh, that's so cool, because it's the 20% is really what I need. And everybody has this like, oh, it's got to be 100% or nothing. It's like, no, 100% is too costly. Oh, and yeah, nothing is too costly. Like they're both have a cost. But if you can modularize and apply what you need and show the return, right? 20% of it, and you're, you know, looking at IoT and you want to, you know, look for flow rates on something. That's all you needed. And that's the alerts you need to be really efficient with your service. Great. Like, okay, we got this. And that may be all you need, right? You may be running this big facility that doesn't need a lot. You need this. And I love that, like, training, so you can start to stack and they can start to decide where to spend the money. And you know, Tanis, we know this, like the too many of these has failed because they've tried to spend too much and don't get it back. And then it gets a bad name. Mm-hmm. And Dylan, you're saying stacking these things and really delivering them again. It's a WIFM, right? It's what does it look like? You know, what do I actually need? And then delivering on it. So I'm interested, Tanis, because I know you want to ask. We want to see where this goes in the future. So I want you to guide it from here.
So as you guys are talking, I'm thinking about Hollywood movies and the carnival guy that's got the microphone. He's like, step right up, get your digital twin right here. That's kind of the impression I get when I'm scrolling through LinkedIn sometimes. And it seems almost transactional. And as you're saying, Dylan, it's not that simple. This is a big undertaking when you're talking about digital twinning, but I like how you break it down into modules. So it doesn't seem quite so overwhelming when you say, let's build a digital twin. It's more, let's build a digital twin for these purposes. And we can start small and build upon it. But building a digital twin does require some early decision-making on yes. the owner's behalf, right? It's probably much easier and much more cost-effective to say, hey, let's build a digital twin at the beginning of a capital project, not so much at the tail end of construction when somebody says, hey, I have an idea. I saw this LinkedIn post. We should explore this. How do you guide people to have that discussion, recognizing that there's probably cost sensitivities in capital project planning, but how do you guide people to have that discussion much earlier than they probably typically are?
Yeah, that's been the plague of BIM in general, right? Is we need to do it earlier, and then I'm on site doing a clash detection that's 2 weeks behind construction. So it doesn't matter, but we're still saying it's, you know, delivering value. I think a good way to get the client to think about that long-term goal or at least be prepared for it is just set up a few data connection points. So saying, if we go into the BIM model that you're going to spend, $10 million building, $2 million building, and we just set up a few parameters that I can later link and make the data connections for a digital twin, set up kind of the bones and the foundation. That's a very small uplift at the beginning. It's a terrible uplift at project handover. So at least give me that piece. And then if you decide later on that a digital twin is something that you're interested in pursuing, we can at least build from that foundation. It's going to be a lot easier for me to grab those data connections, link them to wherever they need to go, set up the data twin in the background with those connections in place, than it is for me to go back and click each individual piece of the BIM model, add a parameter, create that connection, and kind of go at that later stage. I think that also has a problem in the industry where we have, an LOD, right? We're saying we want LOD 200 at this stage, we want 300 at this stage, it's 500 and now it's an FM model. But the actual parameters that we're including in the model geometry is too extensive for a lot of use on construction, but it's way too much for a digital twin. So we're actually paring down actual information in the BIM model to make a better digital twin experience for the owners and the operators. So there's this kind of weird balance that you have to strike where I still need to know model elements and how they are going to exist in the facility, but I don't necessarily need everything that's valuable for engineering and construction to make it to that final model. And I would hate to say that the answer is we have a design model, we have a construction model, then we have a digital twin model, and we're trying to manage all three. But at some point, these models have to transition through a pipeline that makes them more tangible or useful for each individual stage. That's kind of
goes back
the best
to those
way.
Digital threads, right?
Yeah,
it's getting that information instead of that stovepipe model where you're just kind of dumping information in at each stage and hoping the person downstream gets what they need and picks it up and runs with it. It's threading that information through the life cycle of the facility or the asset so that people are getting the data they need when they need it and only the data they need. So it's filtering out that extraneous information that's not necessarily creating value. And when I think about the value of digital twins and through the definition that you've provided, I mean, I think I come from an industrial construction background. So I think a lot about asset maintenance and asset operation. And when you're doing a shutdown or a turnaround, I mean, you're sending crews out to the field to field verify dimensions often, because when that capital project is complete and that model's handed over, to Jeff's point, if it's not kept up, continuously, it's no longer valid. So the question becomes, can you trust the model? And field verifications are very expensive. You're sending crews out to a site to go out with a tape measure and verify dimensions. I mean, having a true-to-life representation digitally of your facility or your asset, if you're doing a smaller component, I mean, the value proposition there seems substantial. Who do you think is going to benefit most in the near term from the digital twinning process?
For sure, it's going to be owners and asset operators and the team that, you know, deals with the facility on a daily basis or the asset on a daily basis. The digital twin is tailored directly to support the data feedback that you're collecting from site and utilizing that in a way that everybody who is connected to that facility or asset can interact with the data in the same way. So it's trying to get rid of the binders of stuff that are in the basement, and it's trying to get rid of the scribble on a napkin that's in someone's drawer that is super important to the shutdown and turnaround, but not everybody is made aware of that because it's not out in the open. It's not easy to access. So the first team that's going to benefit from that for sure, it's going to be the owners and, you know, the end user who's going to utilize the digital twin. And, you know, it's still a process to get them trained and utilize it and trust the model, right? Because if they don't trust the model, that's the first thing that's going to derail the entire thing. It's the same on site. As soon as the guys stop trusting the model, it might as well not exist, because who cares? There's no, you know, incentive to continue to utilize it. So continuously updating the model through point clouds or through, you know, additional modeling through a team or a secondary enterprise or partner is important to keep that level of data so that, like you said, you can just click on a pipe and say, okay, order me a new one. And I don't have to go out and field measure it. And I don't have to go out and spend a week figuring out which steel needs to come off. I can just grab the model. I can rip the steel apart. I can throw, you know, what heavy equipment do I need? Does it fit in that place? Those kind of questions you can answer in that sandbox of a digital twin. And that's why it makes it more valuable for those teams.
I mean, imagine that capability, Jeff. Point, click, and order. I mean, that's, asset owners would have to be excited about that.
Yeah, and it they have to be, right? But it is, you just hit, Dylan, how complicated this really is. Oh, yeah. And why, this is why I get so frustrated with the LinkedIn digital twin marketing clickbait, because you just described like having three different models that don't all need to end up in the same place or in the same state. We need to data deduplicate, right? And not reduplicate effort along the way. But in the end, we needed an effective model that can not only order me that pipe, but you talked about the heavy equipment and can I sequence it and actually do it? And if anywhere in there I do it and it doesn't work, I scrap the whole thing. And that's the problem that the industry has, is that this is, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of dedication. You've got to be not just dedicated to it, but you got to be committed that this is the way we're going to do it, right? It can't be, and we do this far too often with too much. I'm just going to go halfway. I'm just going to try it, Tanis. I'm just going to try a little digital twinning on this one. That's not how you do it. And that's not how people like Dylan have built a career, right? You are career BIM, VDC, IPD, big project, tools and technology and change to get to a point where you can guide people through this process. That's a career, man. That's not a clickbait, I buy it and go.
Yeah.
And we just don't give that enough credit for what it takes. And but if you're a facilities owner, Dylan, talk about, I mean, just replacing that one piece like that, just knowing your asset better, like talk about how that drives value and why some of your current customers, I'm sure, are repeat customers. Like they see this experience and come back. What brings them back to the table for the next project?
I think a lot of it is like authenticity. So just being authentic in what a digital twin is, the complexity that it takes, what it's going to deliver, and then, you know, be authentic in how you're explaining, you know, the benefits that they're going to get from a digital twin. If the owner only wants to do, you know, one module and they just want to see how their pumps are performing through a sensor, like, we don't need to push them to go to the extreme. We can just deliver that, and we can take a predictive data set. We can take the actual data set. We can say, you know, you're running this much more efficient because you're using this digital twin, rather than just, you know, deciding to trust some guy's gut instinct on when something should be replaced. That's probably the best way to, you know, guide the client into something that they're going to utilize and not just scrap the second it hits a hurdle. You know, being authentic in that digital twin seems like it's a click away, but it's not. And it might not always fit your tech stack, and there might be glitches and there might be bugs, and you might spend more time in the front end training your staff on how to use it. And there's all these unknowns, and it can be very scary, and it can be very, you know, up in the air. But the truth is that digital twinning is taking data and it's processing it in a way for you to make better data-driven decisions. And those data-driven decisions are going to make your asset operate more efficiently, or they're going to help your team maintain the asset in a more efficient way. Those are just the hard truths. So any way you get them there is the journey to get them there is where you really have to kind of guide them and just be open and honest in what it takes and what it looks like.
Jeff, I have to jump in with one more. And usually I like recording in person, but today I'm going to be happy that we're recording remotely, because I'm going to drop the AI question. And I know we had some discussion on that on the ECC stage when we broadcast live last week. But Dylan, what is your prediction for the impact of AI on digital twinning in the near term?
I think AI in digital twinning will be focused on the ability to grab that data inside the digital twin in a more user-friendly experience. So being able to ask, instead of clicking through a UI or UX, I can just say, hey, digital twin, show me pumps that are underperforming. And it queries the model data or the data twin that's already there, and it gives you that information. I don't think it's going to be like, hey, AI, make me a digital twin. Here's my model. Do what you need. It might help teams build connections between data and model elements, but I think for now it's really analyzing the data in the back end and then providing ways to interact to the users in a more efficient way.
That's great, and a very practical response. And Jeff is not throwing a virtual shoe at me because nope. I think Jeff is very much aligned with the way you're approaching it. I mean, can AI create value in the digital twinning process? Absolutely. Is it going to revolutionize and completely change and lower your operations costs by 6,000%? No, that's not realistic. So it's all about incremental value. And I think there's opportunity there, but there's still a lot of data hurdles to get past. And, you know, Jeff and I have this conversation all the time. If you have bad data, AI is not going to do much for you. Yeah. You'll just get wrong answers faster and more, perhaps be a little more excited about those wrong answers. All in all, not a good thing. So you go. AI impact, but not a grandiose impact. Not yet anyway.
No, and I think you're right, Tanis. You're not going to get the shoe this time, because it's about practicality, right? Again, Dylan, because you set this up the way you did with a common data environment, a data twin, this is the power of what, you know, large language models, natural language processing, computer vision, and other things can bring to us. But if we don't have it, and this is what I'm teaching, is like, so many people just, like you said, want to click the button, give me a digital twin, I'm done. That's not how it works. You have to block, tackle, capture, build connections, think through things, be very diligent and thoughtful in what you do, or else none of it's going to work. And that's the thing that gets me is, and it's great to see you doing this in reality. So I want to give you a chance to give your own prediction, or if there's one thing, one myth that you could dispel in in digital twin, what would it be?
Right now at this moment in the industry, that there's any software out there that can just automatically give you a digital twin, or using their software will get you to a digital twin. I think right now where we're at is any digital twin is a bespoke application or product software that utilizes other pieces of tech. But I think right now, if you're making a digital twin, you're making a digital twin. You are not going and buying the latest big A product, and you're gonna plug your model in and plug your database in, and you're gonna get there. Those are all focused on delivering a single type of data, and the digital twin works best when the data you're capturing and utilizing is bespoke to your asset.
I think he can just drop the microphone right there, Dylan. I couldn't have asked you for slap a better answer. Yeah, you do a Tannis and slap it out of the way.
I didn't hit my mic this time.
Yet, we still have news.
That's Dylan, true. That's
we'll
true.
Get you there. So, Dylan, I so appreciate you coming along with us, telling your story. And, you know, not enough people dig into the reality of where we are and just can say those things. And so we appreciate it. And I think you're right. Like, there's no one ring to rule them all. There won't be. And digital twins aren't easy. So thanks for continuing to fight out there and teach out there and bring us all along. And I so appreciate having you here today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's great to talk about stuff like this with people in the industry that know what's happening and they see all sides to it. So it's great.
Awesome. Well, listen, don't worry. Dylan's not going anywhere because we got the construction technology news of the week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. Tannis, what do you got?
Well, first off, I want to thank Dylan for a great interview. It's so refreshing to have a practical perspective on digital twinning. And anybody that follows me or Jeff on LinkedIn knows that I can get a little worked up at times around some of the digital twin content. So it's so great to have a conversation around where we are, what's possible today, what might be possible tomorrow, and the work that goes into doing this. This is not just a click the button and build it type of scenario. On that note, my news of the week is titled "Construction Tech Providers May Be Overlooking Their Most Important Users." So this just came out September 3rd, Geo Week News. That we'll throw the link in the show details. So if you want to read up on it, please do. But the key takeaways from this article here are that technology companies really need to focus and invest in understanding what field workers, construction trade workers actually want and actually need. And we have this discussion all the time. We talk about the process flows that occur on site, the difficulty in task execution, data collection, and all of that. Yet often at conferences, we're talking about AI and robots and drones and laser scanning and all kinds of awesome technology. But Your pipe fitter on site might not be super excited about drones when they're using pens and paper and can't get the latest drawings. So the disconnect there is very real. And I mean, this article was a little bit pointed, and I like it because it was direct, but very factual in terms of where the industry sits today. The key takeaways in the article: for any technology tool to be useful on job sites, it needs to conform to the context of the job site. So you can't just kind of build a unicorn and expect that the job site is going to completely change how things happen to revolve around the technology. That's not going to take place. So reality setting, it's got to be useful in the context of how job sites actually operate today. Innovating in construction tech is not a top-down endeavor. You're not going to go sell it to the CEO and they're going to go and mandate it for use on all construction sites. That's not how tech works. You have to get the buy-in. You have to prove what's in it for the end user. And if you're ignoring them and hoping you're just going to sell it through management, you're not going to be very successful because the end user is not going to want to use it. So it's got to be both top down and bottom up. And third, leaders in the construction technology space need to spend time on job sites. You cannot learn construction secondhand. And reading comments on LinkedIn is not going to give you enough information about what happens on construction sites to build technology that supports construction. So if you are out there building tech, if you're a founder, if you're a developer, if you are in product sales, marketing, and you can get on a job site, go do it. Buy some boots, get a hard hat, rub it in the dirt a little bit so you don't look like the new guy or girl walking around site, blend in, but go out there and talk to people, understand it. And if you have an opportunity to do a field rotation and you work in the office, do that too. The more people spend time on site and have conversations with those end users, those people who are actually out there building these facilities and making it happen, the better technology we're going to have, the better processes we're going to have, and the better supported end users are going to be. End of rant. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I'm gonna take this a little bit because I love this. This was from Usman Shuja, CEO, new CEO of Bluebeam, really reinvigorating Bluebeam, right? They've become one of the largest, quietest, you know, tools in the industry, right? And fantastically built by talking to the customers and being customer centric. The one thing I will say though is you're right, get out there and experience it. You don't know the problems if you aren't experiencing it. And even if that means, you know, you're Dylan and you're modeling and you're doing the BIM and the VDC side of things and you're sitting in the trailer and you're having a snack and having lunch in the lunchroom with the folks that are going through the problems, you're listening. They air their grievances all the time. And just standing there and looking around, and actually for somebody like me who's truly an IT person, so every time I go on a job site, I'm way out of my world. It just gives me an appreciation for what's going on. But there is a distinction that I want to draw here that I think Bluebeam and others are a little bit guilty of. Being customer-centric and listening too much to customers. You need to be customer centric and understand their problems. But, and this is attributed to Steve Jobs, but it was not Jobs who said it, that how can a customer tell you what they want if it's never been invented? It's our job to be inventive, to invent solutions to problems that didn't previously exist. Because unfortunately, if you listen too much to your customers, you're going to take your brand new Ford car and you're going to hook up horses to try and make it go faster because that's what they're going to tell you they want. It's not what they need. So you got to listen, but then you actually need to build products that solve problems in ways and are larger than they were in the beginning. So to me, this is where, you know, like, again, not to call Bluebeam out, but like Bluebeam became very much an estimator tool. And in my world, when I first found it, I used it as an automation tool and a process tool for stamping and getting sign off on POs and things like that. And it got more and more costly and centric on a certain group in our environment. And so it became less useful across my organization. And I saw a drop there. I've seen that consistently with companies pivoting. So being customer centric, but also then maintaining a diligence around, you know, what technology can do and how to build it in a user experience, going and getting UI and UX people to really understand the depth of your product. So Dylan, you're shaking your head. I'm kind of interested what you think on all this.
Well, like everybody always says, the customer is always right. But like the full quote is the customer is always right in matters of taste. So yes. Whenever you're trying to listen to this very, very vocal minority and, hey, wouldn't it be cool if the software did this and it did this? And yeah, maybe it would be cool. But as an actual user of the software, I didn't need that feature. I don't need my Bluebeam to, you know, call somebody up for me and have a video call through a PDF editor. That's not what I bought it for. That's not what it's what I'm going to use it for. I think Autodesk is a little guilty of this recently too, having a lot of development in Revit. You know, my standard modeling tool, I want to make construction documents. I want them to be, you know, precise. I want the tools to work. And a big announcement is we have better parametric massing for urban design and study. And it's like, I mean, that's super cool, but that isn't what, isn't the tool that I want to use for that process. And it has no benefit to me as somebody making those construction documents or utilizing the model for clash detection, which is where we are always saying is the most value. So yeah, just software providers in general, looking at all the things they could do instead of the things they should do, it's can be a little bit blurry and problematic.
I love that you brought that quote all the way through, because I just saw that from somebody else, is the customer is always right in matters of taste. And that is very distinctly different than the customer is always right. Yeah. And they're not, quite frankly, they are not. No. And, but their problems are important and should be, Tanis, yeah, at the key, at the forefront. So, you know, we're building our, you know, this is an ode to another podcast, but we're building our tensile strength to have these difficult conversations amongst the software companies and the users and just this industry as a whole.
It fascinates me how many misattributed quotes there are in the innovation space, because as you were talking, I was thinking about the Henry Ford, everybody claims it was Henry Ford, but apparently that's a misattributed quote too. If I would have asked customers what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. But it's still a great quote. Whoever came up with it, good for you. But I mean, you're spot on, Jeff and Dylan. It's about building upon that foundation. So if you understand what the workflow is, what the pain points are, you can innovate atop of that. Not all your innovations are going to be great. Some of them will hit, some of them will miss, but you have a greater chance of successfully innovating if you've got a good foundation. So for example, when the car came out, I mean, transportation needs were generally understood, right? Most people had probably been on a horse and buggy. It didn't go as fast as they wanted, perhaps wasn't as reliable because horses kind of do their own thing sometimes. And innovation atop of that makes a lot of sense. So it almost, I'm a millennial. It reminds me of a Simpsons episode, because I used to spend probably more time in my childhood than I should have watching The Simpsons. But the car for the modern man, when Homer was able to design a car and it, you know, was supposed to be something that consumers would like, and they debuted it and it was like the most atrocious thing anybody had ever seen. Good for Homer, not good for the general public. So innovation is great, but you need the right foundation to do that upon. And Jeff, I think you're spot on. It's, you know, you can go out to a job site and ask people what they want and you're going to get 6,000 opinions. That doesn't mean all of those opinions are correct. So you have to filter through them, understand what fits, what doesn't, what could fit, what might not fit, and iterate that way. And you're not always going to get it right, but you'll have a better sense of which direction to go.
Yeah. And you're not going to make everybody happy. That's just impossible. No. So you have to realize that what you're doing is the best decision for your product as a whole and its and most of its users and more of its usability. So it's key.
Yeah. There's one thing as well is, I feel like some software is trying to cater down as well. So instead of here's this user group that's going to take the software, utilize it to its full potential, now I need to start kind of simplifying it for the general mass or for more mass appeal. And then that software loses the edge that was originally so unique or beneficial. So it is a balancing act. You can't make it so unique, but you also can't dumb it down so that it's not useful for anybody.
There's an absolute balance there. You're right, Dylan. And that's why, you know, that's why you were building the digital twins in a modular perspective, because certain modules are for certain people and need power and need the complexity, and others need simplicity. and that we got to deliver to those users what they need, when they need it, how they need it. So yeah. Key, great article though, Usman, keep it going. Cause you know, really, really excited to see what you're doing out there. I'm going to jump us in to AI and ROI, an either or scenario. And this is one former guest, Rob Iona, awesome Cisco Innovations, you know, in the engineering space, really out there. I don't know, balancing the line, right, between a business and an innovation team, because Cisco Innovations actually invests in new technologies and, you know, things like OpenSpace and others that have become ubiquitous in our world, had their starts with groups like this being a part of it. So Rob's talking out of both sides of his mouth here, and he's admitting it, which I love. Anybody who admits that kind of thing is speaking to me. So what he's talking about is all of the investment opportunity and all of the incredible AI opportunities that we see. I think even me, somebody who's very much on the, we're at the height of inflated expectations, and we're about to go into the trough of disillusionment on most of them, except, you know, maybe some chatbots, et cetera, right? Maybe creating a cool title to a podcast episode, maybe, you know, that we're not there yet. But it's going to take money, and it's going to take investment, and it's going to take guts. And so there's that portion of him that's thinking about that investment and the needs for it. But he's also realizing that you can't just be looking at the ROI, that, you know, I think it like this, but where's the ROI hiding? We're investing like drunken sailors, hoping our GDP will moonwalk into the trillions. Like, he's balancing it with, listen, it's probably not a great business decision, and that this is cool and amazing, but they're roadblocks to getting truly benefits for a company. So he's looking at both sides and saying, like, inside their engineering group, they're being careful. Inside their investment and innovation group, they're being bold. And that, you know, if you can't balance those two, you need to understand where you're coming from. And I think, Tanis, this is a cool, you know, walk the line moment for someone to come out and talk about. And, you know, Rob's one of those people that's just bold about where he's, what he's thinking and what he's doing.
Absolutely. And I think those discussions are important. I spent a little bit of time on a LinkedIn thread recently having a similar conversation, and some of the comments were really insightful, but it was a post about the need for innovation investments to translate into financial gain for the company. And I challenged that position. I think there's a lot of opportunity to innovate where it's not necessarily immediately going to be recognizable in a profit and loss statement, but still creates value, perhaps not financial value for the organization. I mean, safety advancements are a great example of that. Doing what's right might not impact the P&L, but it's still right. And it's an advancement that benefits people and ultimately the organization over the long term. So people really were a little bit polarized on this thread, and, you know, looking at the need to balance, you know, how much are you investing in innovation and how much does the organization need to get back? And that was with AI and a variety of other technologies. But I think you need both, because if your only metric is financial benefit, your team is not incentivized in any way to push boundaries where there's no financial gain. And some of those boundary pushes are going to result in some of the most substantial innovations in our industry that impact people and not necessarily the bottom line. So I'm very much a proponent of you need both. If you're just focused on ROI, you're going to miss the mark when it comes to innovation.
Yeah. Dylan, I'm interested in your thoughts on balancing and walking that line.
Yeah. The balance is tough, because I think when you're talking about AI in the industry, the first thing that comes to mind is it's a cost-saving measure, and that cost-saving measure comes at the expense of workers, right? Like, you're reducing overhead to do something that somebody else could do. You're generating art for a report that took a graphic designer and now takes a few prompts. So I think, like, there's a huge ethics discussion, obviously, that needs to be had. But AI as a cost return or something like that is very complicated. I mean, if you just look at AI itself, the most valuable company in the world right now is NVIDIA. And the reason NVIDIA is the most valuable company in the world right now is because AI is in that gold rush stage and NVIDIA is selling shovels. They're not selling AI solutions. They're not selling how to use it to make a better business case. They're just giving you the tool to do what you think is going to be the most valuable proposition. Yep. And I think that's kind of the complexity of it is it's a buzzword. There's lots of hype. We got to use AI. AI is going to change everything. Okay, but you need to plan and say, what is it changing? What is that actually going to help you change something? Or is it just going to reduce your overhead? Or is it going to change the way you look at a project? I think that is really where you're going to determine whether it's ROI or it's investment or, you know, something in between.
I love that analogy. They're selling you shovels and this is going to show a little bit of my current extracurricular passion of watching shows is, you know, and we're selling them pans right now to pan the gold in the river on the edges. And we're going to start building wash plants and we're going to start using big dozers and we're going to start, you know, creating these shaker decks and all this stuff to get as much gold out of it as we possibly can as we continue to
gold rush.
Yep. Gold Rush.
Love it.
Huge
Love
fan
it.
Of all of those shows. Got a chance to meet a couple of them at a ConExpo ConAg. So thanks to ConExpo ConAg, you made my world there. But you're right. And this is, like, for me, the quintessential innovator's dilemma. You must break your company up into the incremental areas of improvement that you can sustain and that drive P&L. Right? That drive dollars back onto that P&L that make you more efficient. That is key. But if we don't have groups, whether it's in your own organization, like they're doing at Cisco and they're breaking it out into two, you've got to do that. You got to allow for that loss and that innovation and those curves to happen and those people to go through the iterations. And they need to be separate. They really do, because one is critical. Both are critical to business and both are really hard to do at the same time. Right, you really can't. So you got to break it up. So it is the dilemma, and the dilemma here is that, you know, we've done our day, and I got to wrap us up. The news was fun. The interview was fun. You know, Tanis, it's amazing we get to do this on a regular basis and have a good time.
It's one of the best parts of my week when we get to sit down with. I mean, each other, we have a great time dialoguing, but guests like Dylan and all the other awesome people we have on the show, hearing insights from people who are actually out there making this happen. I mean, it's exciting and it's inspiring and it gets you thinking about where we're headed as an industry. I always leave these sessions really excited about the future of technology and construction. So I always appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, and we would just end up arguing over the same things if we didn't have wonderful guests like Dylan. Dylan, thanks so much for sitting down and articulating the ideas and challenging us. It's awesome to hear about those stories and what you're actually doing out there.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's, you know, always fun to have a place to nerd out about something and everybody's eyes don't just glaze over immediately. So I appreciate the opportunity.
You are always safe in the nerdosphere over here with us at the Contact Crew. So you got to open. I can't wait to meet you in person and see you out there. Thanks again for sitting down with us. Thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Dylan Underhill. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontactcrew.com. This is the Contact Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.